13-20-143-CV Diana Garza versus Jose Ochoa. Mr. Wenske, is that correct?
Wineski, yes, Your Honor.
Wineski. All right, Mr. Wineski.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Paul Wineski, and I'm with the law firm of Bailey & Gallion, and I'm here today, excuse me, arguing on behalf of Diana Garza, who was the plaintiff below, in the appeal of the no evidence motion or summary judgment that was granted to the defendant, Mr. Ochoa. And before I get started, I just want to note, when I was preparing for this oral argument, it occurred to me that this issue probably would have been better presented in a traditional motion for summary judgment, since the existence of duty is a question of law, and it could have been a simple motion for summary judgment asserting that the defendant had no duty. But it was presented and granted as a no evidence motion for summary judgment, so that's where we are. So this case is about duties, what duties exist and whether the defendant breached them. And in this case, we believe there are actually three interrelated duties involved. The first is the duty owed by a dog owner to exercise reasonable care to avoid foreseeable injury to others by the dog. The second is the duty of an owner of property abutting a highway to exercise reasonable care not to jeopardize the safety of persons traveling on the highway. And the third is the duty of a party who negligently creates a dangerous situation to do something about it to prevent injury to others, if it reasonably appears or should appear to him that others in the exercise of their lawful rights may be injured thereby. And the foremost question in determining duty is foreseeability. And for foreseeability, we have the Caldera Declaration. Ms. Caldera was a neighbor of both the plaintiff and defendant in that they all lived along the same farm to market road. And Ms. Caldera took daily walks around the neighborhood. And her route each day took her past the defendant's property. And she observed every time that she went by and every time that a motor vehicle went by that property, three dogs would run from the defendant's house down his drive and out into the highway. This happened every day for a period of over 3 years before the accident in question. Now, the restatement that I have cited in our brief states that one who keeps a domestic animal is required to know its normal habits and tendencies. It was the normal habit and the tendency of these dogs to run to the highway every time a motor vehicle passed. And this happened every day for 3 years. Therefore, it was reasonably foreseeable and easily foreseeable to Ochoa that those dogs might cause a driver to try to swerve or emergency brake or otherwise have an accident. And that imposed upon Ochoa a duty to do whatever was necessary to keep his dogs out of the road.
So what that's given in the neighbor's affiant or declaration, was there any indication that Mr. Ochoa was made aware or as a neighbor complained your dogs are getting into or he was outside or any indication of notice to Mr. Ochoa that
no,
his dogs were getting out into the highway?
No, there was not, Your Honor.
Okay. So how do we put the dog owner, as you've indicated, as a duty, that he has a duty, if we don't have any evidence that he had knowledge of his dogs getting out into the street?
Well, under the cases which cite the restatement section that I'm speaking of, section 518 of the restatement second of torts, the law imposes upon the owner knowledge of the normal habits and tendencies of his domestic animals. And in this particular case, based on the declaration of Ms. Caldera, it was the normal daily habit and tendencies of his animals to run out into the roadway every time a car came by. And that, that together with the foreseeability of a serious car accident as a result, placed a duty on Mr. Ochoa to keep his dogs out of the roadway. Now, I'd like to talk about a couple of cases because they are analogous to the case at bar. The first is Ogden versus the estate of Pettis. And these are all cited in our briefs. And in that case, a dog running at large ran out into the street and attacked a bicyclist pulling a child carrier with his 17-month-old child in it. And there were injuries. And so the injured parties sued the dog owners for having the dog at large. and the dog owners filed a motion for summary judgment, stating that they had never observed any violent or vicious propensities in their dog prior to this incident in question. And the trial court granted summary judgment based on that basis. The Court of Appeals, though, said not so fast. These affidavits only address the behavior of this dog while he's hanging out in the family's feed store. They don't say anything about his propensity to chase moving objects while running at large. Therefore, they have not negated a duty, and the summary judgment was reversed. The same thing should happen in the present case, because in this case, we have the opposite. We have a very detailed account of how these animals behave the same way every day with respect to moving objects on the roadway while running at large. And after 3 years of this conduct, it is not reasonable to assume that Mr. Ochoa didn't know about it. And the other point in the Ogden case is that determining what a reasonable person would have done or what he should have known is a question of fact, which will preclude summary judgment and should have precluded summary judgment in this case. The other case I would like to talk about is the Golden Villa versus Smith case, which this court actually relied on in its opinion in Silva versus Phone Health Systems Corporation. And that has to do with the duty of a owner or occupant of premises abutting a highway to exercise reasonable care not to jeopardize or endanger the safety of persons using the highway. And Golden Villa's facts are remarkably similar to the facts of the case at bar. Golden Villa was a skilled nursing care center, and they had a patient who had been there for several years who had what we probably today would call Alzheimer's or dementia, but was described in the opinion as senility, confusion, and a tendency to wander. And they were put on notice of these tendencies when she was admitted, and the nursing home records indicated that this only got worse the longer that she lived there. And to the extent that the doctors at the nursing home had to recommend that she be physically restrained from time to time to keep her from wandering. The staff knew that she had wandered off the premises before. The staff knew that she'd wandered off into and across the highway in front of the premises before. And so they were under orders to keep her under close supervision. Well, on the day in question around lunchtime, she was last seen sitting on the front porch of the facility. But then she was not observed for almost an hour. Well, sure enough, during that hour, she got up, wandered across the yard, through the unlocked gate, and over to the edge of the highway, where she believed she spotted some money in the roadway. And so she darted out to get it. At the same time that a motorcyclist was passing by and they collided, both she and the motorcyclist sustained injuries, and they both sued the nursing home. And the court said, the patient constituted a clear and present danger to travelers who would swerve or otherwise attempt to avoid hitting her if she was on the highway. Appellant, by its failure to keep the patient from wandering onto the Highway 35, breached the duty it owed to the motorcyclist, and this breach was the proximate cause of the motorcyclist's injuries. The similarities cannot be more clear. The only difference in this case is that it was a dog owned by Mr. Ochoa rather than a patient in the care of the Golden Villa nursing home that was known beforehand to have a tendency to wander out in the roadway and yet was not controlled so that it could not run out into the roadway and cause an accident, whether with the patient in the Golden Villa case or trying to avoid the dog in this case. I'm going faster than I thought I would. I do want to say a word about Hayes versus Blake, which I'm sure you'll hear a lot about from opposing counsel. And without getting into the details of the case, because I'm sure that she will, let me just say that we believe that that case is an outlier that was wrongly decided, and therefore the court should not give it any consideration and certainly should not rely on it in its decision of this case. And the reasons are several. In the first place, it is the first and only case in the state of Texas to conflate the free range doctrine, which we all know applies to livestock, with the common law duty that dog owners owe to the general public to exercise reasonable care to keep their dogs from inflicting foreseeable injury. The second reason that it should not be relied upon is that for its holding, it cites...
So, Mr. Wojnarowski, you think that all the law that we have in the state of Texas and that we all were raised on, which is that Texas is an open range or a fence out, doesn't apply in this case because it's a domestic and not dealing with cattle or horses or other livestock?
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly our point.
Okay.
And what I'm saying, what I was about to say, is that the two cases that were cited in Hayes versus Blake for the holding that it made, which we believe is erroneous, were both free range livestock cases. And I will say that the old Clarendon Land Company case, which is one of the two cases cited, this quote doesn't appear in Hayes versus Blake, but it does appear in the case, talking about a man can let his dog run at large with impunity as long as he doesn't know him to be vicious. Number one, that was dicta and is dicta because it was not necessary to the decision in that case. And more importantly, Hayes versus Blake was written in 1893 in a completely different world than the one in which we exist today. The automobile had not been invented or even envisioned. High-speed highways had not been invented or even envisioned. And so the thought that a dog at large could leap in front of a car traveling at 60 miles an hour down a paved highway was simply inconceivable to the authors of that opinion, and might have had a bearing on the dicta that they did enunciate. So we believe that Hayes versus Blake is in fact an outlier. It is a unreported, no pet case. It was decided in the year 2000 and has not been cited a single time by any other court for that proposition or any other. And so we are asking the court to simply disregard that case as being wrongly decided and go on under the principles that we've laid out in our briefing.
Can I also talk about, you know, we also, this case reminded me so much of law school, that the whole adage of you get your first bite free, you know, first dog bite free, which goes with the vicious analysis of, you know, you have to have that knowledge that the dog is vicious. And then if you do, then you have to make sure that your dog can't get out. So can the analysis of vicious also pertain to dogs that some dogs stray from homes and some dogs don't? We've all had some dogs that will stay in our yard and other ones that will dart across the street. Can the same analysis be applied in these circumstances, that if we were to impute some knowledge that if you knew your dog was going to get out, then you had a duty then to make sure it didn't get out? That you had to have that prior knowledge first.
I have two responses to that. In the first place, since we were not going under a strict liability theory, but rather a negligent handling theory, it is not required that one prove that the owner knew the dog was vicious. But number two, there are a variety of cases, and we've cited them in our brief, where that rule was extended and said if the owner did not know that the animals were vicious or unruly. Now, there's no proof one way or the other whether the dogs in this case were vicious, but they were clearly unruly under the declaration of Ms. Caldera and the results of the accident that happened here. And that principle is not even limited to dog cases. That also applied to a goat that butted a woman at a petting zoo at Six Flags Over Texas and caused her to fall and have injuries. It was applied to the hog, I believe, in Marshall versus Ranny. And also to the mules driving the wagon down Main Street in Houston, Texas, that collided with another wagon to kill a man. So it is not limited to vicious. It is vicious or unruly. And these dogs, by any definition, were and probably continue to be unruly and a hazard to anybody driving past Mr. Ochoa's property. And for that reason, we ask the court to reverse the no evidence summary judgment that was rendered below and to remand this case for trial on the merits or at least further proceedings. And that, I believe, is going to conclude my argument. I will see you guys on rebuttal unless somebody has a question.
Justice Longoria, Justice Tejerina?
No, not at this time.
Very good. All right, Mrs. Boatwright, when the clock is reset to 20, I'm sorry, which it has been, you may begin your argument.
Your Honor, may it please the court. Basically, I want to respond to what Mr. Wineski said, but I also want to point out that the only argument that was presented to the trial court in this case was that involving the claims related to negligent handling of an animal. The abutting highway was not presented. And so under Rule 166A, we have a question as to whether that should even be considered. And of course, neither of those were specifically pled either. However, I mean, going on, I'm sure the court wants me to address this. And I will believe I was called wistful in the brief when I referred to the free range history in Texas. And I followed the free range history, starting with the Clarendon Land Investment Agency case, which was, I think Mr. Wineski said the Hayes versus Black case was decided in 1893. It's the Clarendon case, and it was decided in 1893 before an automobile and before high-speed highways. We do have an automobile involved in this case. We do not have a high-speed highway, so I don't know that that has anything to do with this. And it was the Supreme Court in that case, which I call the McClellan brothers case, which compared livestock to dogs. That's not something we invented. That's been around for well over 100 years. And it was in that particular case that the court said, you know, like a dog, like all domestic animals, livestock have to be fenced out, not fenced in. We have a free range history. And although that was decided in 1893, as recently, thereafter in 1999 in the Gibbs case, Justice Abbott basically confirmed that that was still the case. Now there are some changes that occurred, and I'll talk about those in a minute because I think those are extremely important to the issue of whether there is a general duty to restrain a dog, because I think the answer is no. But then the Supreme Court once again last year in 2020 in the Preske versus Garcia case basically reconfirmed this whole line of cases and this whole set of reasoning. Now, these are all livestock cases. That is true. I'm not trying to say that this dog is a steer or a cow or a bull. It's a dog. But the legislature, in response to these changes that concern Ms. Garza, made laws, and they were, I mean, they were delegated by the Constitution to have this responsibility. They made laws regarding when cattle can be held liable for running into roadways and when not. And there are specifically enunciated or listed animals that are found that are covered by those laws. And those are the stock laws that we all know about. We all know if you get a cow case, you got to go find out if the county has a stock law to figure out whether you have a defense or whose burden it is. And those basically allow local determination of that question. Well, we don't have something called the stock laws, but we do have the Health and Safety Code, Chapter 822, which essentially does the same thing with dogs. And these laws, at least as most recently codified, were codified in the 1980s and in the 2000s. And in these particular laws, the legislature said, this is a matter of local concern and the locals should make this determination, whether through an election as in 82.021, or whether the governing body of the county or municipality makes that decision under 822.007. This is a matter of local determination. So the legislature has addressed this issue. The legislature has said, like the stock laws, this is a matter where the locals know more what's going on. And I believe that's essentially the argument that was used in
the press. But right, what has occurred, I think, in most urban areas now, and to a certain extent in rurals, is that we now have city codes that do not let you have your dogs run unrestrained. They must be on leashes, at least in every city I've lived so far. In the Valley and here in Corpus Christi have restraints. So my understanding was we believed that this had occurred in the city and then through discovery have learned that this did not occur within the city limits of Kingsville. Is that correct?
That is my understanding. At page 18 of appellant's brief, they acknowledge that the Kingsville leash law does not apply. Okay. So
I understand that, but that's not my question then leads to the analysis. So I know that the legislature has said we have the Stockyards and we have the locals, but there has been a recognition by statute and by local leash laws that says owners, you have a duty to keep your dogs on the leash and not run around. And so what I seem to hear Mr. Wineski argue is that duty that's been codified to a certain extent in cities, but hasn't been codified to the county, should apply. We should recognize that duty. Not that there's a code here because we're outside of the city limits, but when we aren't in an area where there's a government entity that could do that, that we should recognize this duty that has been recognized by these urban areas. Well, do you understand my question?
I think so. let me correct part of it if I can.
Of course, yes, of course.
Presumptuous, but I think you said where there are not local governments that can adopt these duties. The laws, Chapter 822, specifically gives the right to municipal or county governments to adopt these laws. It also gives the citizens of the county the right to adopt the laws. So these two things basically mean that there is not a place where you cannot do this. You can do this anywhere. It's just right. Essentially cities, urban areas have generally chosen to do it. Rural areas, to a large extent, and I believe, in fact, one of the cases we cited from Kendall County had some kind of leash law in effect or a law that had been passed by the county. So there is not a place in Texas where this cannot be done. It can be done everywhere.
Right.
And the legislature basically said the best place to do this is the locality at issue, whether it's the county or the city. They are the people who have the best information to make this decision.
So if there is no statute for whatever reason, my question then goes, do we then not still recognize the duty that a dog owner has to ensure that their dog is not creating a dangerous condition?
Not without upsetting the legislative design on this issue. Okay. And for that matter, a lot of Texas history, which said we're a free range state unless otherwise done. And in this particular case, the legislature has acted. The legislature has regulated when you can have leash laws or confinement laws and when you can't. And that's basically a local decision. I know that the plaintiffs presented a lot of cases that said, oh, well, there's all this general negligence out there that can apply. And they cite all these cases and say, well, they didn't discuss the specific stock law, or they didn't discuss the specific municipal ordinance. And I would ask the court to go look at Prusky, which is the 2020 case that held that, I can't remember if it's a cow or a horse at this point, but that the, I think it was a horse, whether you could have, whether the standard was knowingly or not. And the Prusky court, as well as the court in Phillips versus Crow, which is also cited in the briefs, basically talks about the fact that negligence is thrown around a lot in these cases, but it relates back to the statutes. That's where the standards come from, are these statutes. And without these statutes, there is no standard of negligence and no negligence in the allowance of stock law, I mean, cattle, domestic animals, dogs, to run free. And that's really the expectation of most people who live in rural areas. Many people who live in rural areas go there to get out from under all of the municipal taxes and the municipal rules and to live out there. They may live out there because they don't have the money to live in town. And so they've gone out there specifically for these reasons. And we're talking
all right,
about
can
trying
I ask
to
you a question here.
Sure.
Would it have made a difference? Because this is a no contact case, right?
That is correct.
So would it have made a difference if there was contact?
Well, that's one of my arguments against all these general negligence laws as well, is that the only way these laws, any of the laws that the plaintiff has been arguing apply, these duties, have been in cases in which the dogs attacked somebody. I mean, there's no dog case out there in this case that didn't attack somebody. We've got a goat that butted somebody. The only case they have cited in which I can't specifically tell you that there was aggression of an animal on a person was the, I think it's called the Paccarello case. It's the case that Mr. Wisniewski referred to.
I'm not talking about vicious dogs or attacks. We all know what dogs do when you drive by. They're not trying to attack you. They have something that just causes them to want to run beside the vehicle, instinct or something. But if a large dog ran out and hit a car and caused property damage, would there be any kind of liability with the dog owner? Forget about bodily injury, just property damage.
Your Honor, I think under the current state of law, the answer is no, there wouldn't be. In this particular case, this is not the record, but I mean, the plaintiff didn't have a driver's license and she was cited by the police officer for faulty evasive action. And so I think there's obviously an argument that, as you said, if a dog runs along you, if you keep running, you're not going to have an issue. And so I do think the fact that there was no contact is a point in our favor, but I'm not sure that it would make a difference in the ruling. I think essentially this is a case in which the local people have to determine if this is a problem for them, they will either ask their representatives to pass this law or they will ask for an election where they can adopt the law that the federal government has actually put into place. I mean, the state government has put into place. So I think.
With regards to the stock laws, if the local governments have not enacted the liability against the ranch owners or the farm owners, then it's the duty of the driver to avoid the animal.
That's correct.
And if they adopt them, then it switches and correct. It's the duty of the landowner to keep their livestock within the bounds of their property. Is that how the stock laws work?
That's correct. Essentially, it's a shifting of the burden and as to who has the duty. And if the stock laws have been passed, then the livestock owner has the duty to keep them in. Now, there is the one about keeping them off the highway, but this was not a highway. This is a farm to market road.
And I worked in municipal law for a while, and I know there are some things that municipalities can do and other things that counties cannot do with regards to health and safety and adoption of codes and ordinances. But are you saying that the counties have a specific ability to adopt leash laws?
I am saying that pursuant to 822.007, this is basically that this does not prevent them from doing so. Now, I know that in a lot of instances, the way a county achieves this is they join in with the city, a nearby city, and form a kind of a cooperative to do it. And then the county can enforce them as well. That's the way I have seen it done in the past as well. But the people in a county can also hold an election to adopt those provisions, which is presented by 822.021. So it's clear that they have the option, that the state has granted them the option. So, basically, also, I'd like to point out a distinction. Although appellant says there's nothing that says this is limited to a dog actually physically attacking somebody, every case that it has been looked at is a case of a physical attack. And in fact, the language basically in the restatement on which they rely talks about the fact that all of these cases are to prevent attacks. The actual location of the dog has never been the issue in one of these situations. And the restatement specifically has, and I'm looking for my Dunnings case because it's in Dunnings, the restatement specifically has a provision that talks about the handling of animals issue and that explains where the handling of animal comes from in terms of the propensities that they are charged with knowing. And the specific example that they use is you can read it at Dunnings at page 562, I believe. And it says, that the dangerous propensities you're charged with are not just general dangerous propensities, but that under particular circumstances, you have to exercise reasonable care to prevent foreseeable harm. So too, the keeper of an ordinary gentle bitch or cat is required to know that while caring for her puppies or kittens, she is likely to attack other animals and human beings. And so that's specifically the example that is used to support the part of 518, Texas Restatement of Torts 518, that the appellants rely on. And by the way, the one that is relied on by Marshall versus Ron is an earlier version. And I think it's quoted in appellant's brief. I have not found the earlier version yet, but I don't think it's the same one that is cited by the appellant. As to my reliance on the McClendon brothers or the Clariton Investment Agency, Land Agency, dicta, quote unquote, I would point out that in Marshall versus Ron, that was a strict liability and tort case. And the only comment in there about 518 really is we're not limiting 518, or we're not saying that couldn't happen in 518. And that's what everything that the appellants are relying on came from. So I think dicta is kind of a weak attack on what this is. I do cite the Hayes versus Black case. The Hayes versus Black case it's a 2000 case out of Austin. We don't actually think it's an outlier. We think it is the correct decision. And we have cited a lot of stock laws cases analogous to it that basically say the same thing. So we think that they actually analyzed the law correctly, and that without an ordinance, there is no specific duty. I would also point out, in terms of adopting a duty, we don't think there is a duty, I think, as we've said, because this is purely about the dog's location. It is not about the aggressiveness of the dog. And there is no evidence in this case. I mean, the only complaint they have about our dog is where it was. They don't have a complaint about its aggressiveness. It didn't attack, it didn't bite, it didn't scratch. But in terms of adopting a duty, we don't think the showing has been made to require the adoption of a duty. We have one incident in 3 years by Ms. Caldera's affidavit herself. This has never happened before in the 3 years that Ms. Caldera has provided us an affidavit, or I assume she would have told us. We have no cases cited about this particular type of accident. So I can assume that it is not a very common type of accident under the history of Texas, and thus is not something crying out for a duty to fix a problem of drunk drivers on the road. We have no evidence of the cost or the burden to the rural residents, how much a fence would cost, how much an electric fence would cost. We don't have a showing to create a duty in this case. And furthermore, we think that that would do harm to the legislative proceeding, as well as, if a court were going to do it, we'd say the Supreme Court would do it, but the Supreme Court just refused to do so. I think I cited a couple of cases in which this court refused to basically find some duties, similar duties as well. On that, we'd ask the court to affirm the finding that there was no negligence per se. We'd ask the court to consider what was presented to the trial court, because as I said, most of these arguments were not presented to the trial courts. We'd ask this court to determine there is no pan-Texas requirement that a dog be restrained, because certainly I don't think anybody living in a rural area expects to have to leash their dog. And this would be a big shock to rural Texas. We'd ask the court not to adopt such a duty because we don't think it is necessary in this case, or that the foundation has been provided to do so. And we'd ask the court to analogize these to the stock laws, as the Supreme Court has done with the Clarendon case, and find that there is no duty and affirm the trial court judgment in all things. Thank you.
Well, Ms. Boatwright complains that these arguments were not presented below, which goes back to the first thing that I said. This case would have been much more cleanly submitted as a traditional motion for summary judgment, where all of the legal arguments could have been delved into. But it wasn't. It was submitted as a no evidence motion for summary judgment. And that is how it was responded to. We had not argued, as Ms. Boatwright suggests, for a general duty to restrain a dog. We have not argued for a pan-Texas duty for all dog owners to restrain all dogs at all times. The duty that we are contending for today is the duty of a dog owner to restrain the dog if the dog owner knows that dog is presenting a hazard to people driving by his property. And the law imposes that knowledge on that owner. Now, Justice Benavides was asking about whether the duty had to be codified before liability could be imposed under negligence. And the answer to that is no, it does not. And this court's own opinion in Evans versus Jalimo says so. The court noted, and that was the appellant's argument in that case, was that there was no statewide dram shop law to back up the tort liability under general negligence in that case. And this court acknowledged that there was no such state law, but and said, since we hold there was evidence of common law negligence, we do not discuss the issues of either negligence per se or negligence under res ipsa loquitur. And the court decided the case under principles of common law negligence, found the bar owner liable, and was affirmed by the Supreme Court in the El Chico versus Poole case. Justice Tiarina asked, would it have made a difference if there had been actual contact, if a large dog had run out and hit the car and caused property damage? And opposing counsel answered no. This court in Warren versus Mills, or Davis, excuse me, Warren versus Davis, answered that question yes. An escaped bull ran out into the road, collided with the car, killed both the bull and the driver. And the, this court affirmed liability against the owner of the bull without mention of any stock laws or free range doctrine. Again, under standard common law principles of negligence, duty, foreseeability, and breach, Mr. Ochoa breached his duty in this case to control his dogs so that they did not present an unreasonable danger to others in the lawful pursuit of their activities. And because of that, the no evidence summary judgment entered below must be reversed. And this case must be returned to the trial court for further proceedings and or trial on the merits.
All right. Any further questions from the panel? Nope. And the case will be under submission.